Kevin?
No. It's Iowa.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. And to all you pops out there, happy Pops Day. Now, I hope you're resting and relaxing. I am working. I did three services this morning, then immediately got on the freeway and drove an hour and a half. Make that actually 2 hours I drove through traffic to get here to spend my afternoon, what's left of it, with you. Glad to do so, but I'll have my Father's Day when I get home. Greg Kokel's the name. The show is Stand to Reason, the marketplace of ideas where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed in the open forum of talk radio. That means you can call in and weigh in on anything you want in the area of ethics, values, and religion. 1-800-227-5278. That's the number to call to give me a piece of your mind. 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150. You can ring that number up. Now, since today is Father's Day, and I have actually done this on occasion in the past, it's been a while. My own dad died in 2001 after spending some 72 or 73 years running from God. In the last year of his life, God got a hold of him and pulled him into the kingdom, and that was a great thing. He died in December of 2001 of a brain tumor, but he had the great advantage of spending about a year, as a follower of Jesus Christ, such as it was for him at that stage in his life. And it is hard to imagine for any of us who has had more influence in our life than our parents, and this is especially true of dads, I think. And so I'd like to talk to you just a little bit about my own father and give you somewhat of a biographical sketch. Part of the reason is, as listeners, I think it's good to get more of a background of me and my life, and there's a little bit of a inside look there. And also, I think that there's something that you may learn from it as well. As I did some reflecting on my own history, my own life with my father, and though I'm honestly not particularly prone to get emotional about this kind of thing, I found myself touched simply by recounting the past and reflecting on the price that my own dad paid on my behalf as one of his five children. And what I'm about to share with you isn't the whole story. I remember last time I talked about this, I had to follow up with the show and say, you know, it wasn't all, you know, peaches and cream. It was hard. But what I have to talk about, though, are the things that were part of my own dad's life that I think made him the kind of person that could make a good contribution in my life. And my dad was actually orphaned when he was 10 years old, when an 18-year-old driver plowed into the car of his parents, killing them both. He was then traded around between relatives and boarding homes until he was about 18, when he met my mom. He met her in Chicago. That's where they lived, at Riverview Rolling Rink. Now, Riverview was a amusement park, kind of like Six Flags Over Texas or whatever they call that. You know, those kinds of things. It was back before they had a lot of those things. I remember going to Riverview as a kid. They tore it down in the late 60s. And there was a roller rink there in the 30s, I guess, which is where my folks met. And amusement park, by the way, had the original Bob's roller coaster, which was famous for how many people had died on it. That was back in the less enlightened era before OSHA, I guess. But in any event, Dad met Mom there at the roller rink, and he married her. They were both 18. And about a year later, when he was 19, my sister Susan was born. And a year and 14 days later, I came along. And then when Dad was 22, came Mark. At 24, David, and 5 days after my dad's 27th birthday, Bonnie was born. That's five kids and a wife at 27. You figure it out. Now, the first 5 years of my own life were spent, or most of them, on a farm near Anago, Wisconsin. That's potato country. And this was a farm that had no running water when we moved in, though later cold water was eventually piped in. The bathroom was an outhouse in the back. I'm not making this up. Rain or shine, summer or winter, a privy. We had some dairy cattle, we had pigs, we had some chickens, we had a Springer Spaniel named Topsy. Mark and Dave were both born while we lived on the farm. And Dad worked at a fertilizer plant during the day and basically did farming at night by the light of his tractor. That's how committed he was to making this happen. My dad began to pay a price of fatherhood rather early during the farm years when, for example, Mark, now 2 years my junior, slurped up some gasoline with a jelly spoon and had to have his stomach pumped. Imagine that. Here he was sucking on the jelly spoon when the gas guy came by, and so he thought he'd suck up some gasoline at the same time. Well, Mark gets his stomach pumped. I fell in a trash pile in the foundation of an old silo on the grounds right next to the barn there, sliced my hand open. I'm looking at it right now. I can still see the scar. That was, 53 years ago? Another time, Mark innocently stuck his finger, get this, into the machinery of the water pump driven by a tall windmill. So there we got this windmill, and it's pumping the water well. And Mark's looking at the mechanism of the water well going boong, 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 up and down and up and down. So he just sticks his finger in there. There goes his finger. It's still twisted to this day. That was a mess. And then on my second birthday, I got my leg busted when somebody backed into me with a pickup truck. Lester, my dad's boss. Not bad for starters for fatherhood. That's what he had to endure. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter. She'll be 2.5 in a week. And I just cringe at having to pick a tick out of her hair when we were in Wisconsin. I mean, I think of, oh, this poor kid. And there's my dad putting up with all of that just in the first couple of years of being a dad. However, the biggest hit came during Easter week 1955 when my parents were awakened by the screeching of our cat to discover our house ablaze. We had an old clapboard farmhouse, two-story. Dad gathered up the kids. That included David, who was about 9 months old at the time and sleeping in his crib in the pantry, the only place they had for him. And I actually clearly recall scrambling out in my underwear with the building blazing behind me. My mom grabbed the only valuable thing she could think of in the moment, believe it or not, a ham. My folks had been given a ham for Easter, and it was a rare and expensive treat for a poor farmer and his family, and that was the first thing that my mom thought of, the ham. My dad grabbed about $32 from the dresser, payment from the cheese factory for milk, and a pair of baby shoes that would probably be David's, and that was it. The $32, the ham, the baby shoes, and four kids and mom and dad were the only thing that escaped that conflagration because we got out just in time. That two-story clapboard farmhouse burned right to the foundation. In fact, for many years afterwards, my dad kept a chunk of change that he dug out of the ashes that was melted altogether from the heat of the fire. I mean, it sat in a clump on his dresser. Copper and silver and pennies and quarters and dimes, either a trophy or a tombstone. I never knew quite which, but there it was, the memento of that fire. And 3 days before Easter, that would be Good Friday, 2 days before Easter, Good Friday, 1955, Antigo, Wisconsin. You see, my dad always wanted to be a farmer. He wanted to work the soil. And now, after the fire, that dream was pretty much over because the fire ruined him financially. Everything he owned, which actually wasn't much, went up in smoke. He was 25. He had four kids and a wife and was bankrupt. My son is 25. To think of somebody like Dane shouldering this kind of responsibility in that age is amazing to me. Well, we stayed for a while in the garage, which was one of the buildings that was still standing. It was a separate building from the house, and Dad, I do that every once in a while. I say God instead of Dad. Maybe that's like a Freudian slip. How many of your dads were God to you, folks? Well, mine was to me, I'll tell you that. So there might be some meaning in that slip. But in any event, Dad insulated this garage so that we'd have some place to live there in the cold spring of northern Wisconsin. But before long, I mean, he just gave it up completely. And I think it was the summer of 55 then. He moved us all back to Chicago, all six of us. Our first stop then in Chicago was Claremont Street, an old Italian neighborhood on the near west side of Chicago. I still remember the small apartment in the basement with the women, the windows up against the ceiling. You know, then you could look up and out onto street level, giving us a view of ankles walking by. Soon after that, we moved into a two-flat that my grandfather owned on the far north side in Rogers Park, just south of Evanston. It was actually close enough to hear the Cubs at Wrigley Field cheering of the crowd, the roar of the fans when Ernie Banks hit a homer. And we were there until four years or so. You know, starting there in 1955 in northern part of Chicago, and I remember the year pretty well because I was in kindergarten there at the time, being shuffled back and forth among three different schools as we relocated. We finally settled in at St. Jerome's Catholic School on the north side, right down the street from what was then the old Adelphi Theater on Clark Street. We used to go see a double bill. Some of you guys don't know what a double bill is. That's like two movies back to back, and you get to see them both for the price of one. And the price then on Saturday afternoon at the matinee was a quarter, 25 cents. And this is where our folks often sent us. It each give us each a quarter for the movie and a dime for some candy or something. And then we couldn't get a box of popcorn. That was 15 cents. That was too expensive. But Mom and Dad would get us out of their hair on Saturdays when we went to the movies at the Adelphi Theater. during that time, my dad made a living by going door-to-door selling pictures for a company called Baby Tots to support this growing family. That was when Bonnie was born, number five. And during our time at Rogers Avenue, we had our own share of adventures as kids. Mark got his eye poked out, or I shouldn't say poked out, but poked badly. With a stick. I don't know what he was doing, but my stick went in his eye. I don't know who was on the giving end of that, actually. But then Mark had his front teeth bashed in when David threw a Tinker Toy can at him. Mark was always getting it. Drinking the gasoline, getting his finger smashed, getting his eye poked, getting his teeth bashed in from the Tinker Toy can. And I guess David just thrown it at him, and it flipped through the air, and the edge of the can connected with his front teeth. Of course, then David got his when he tumbled down the basement stairs and drove his front teeth up into his gums. And I'm feeling empathy pains right now, but there's more. When I was eight, I jumped from a swing at Pottawatomie Park across the street from our house. I busted my arm, and I remember standing up, standing at the curb with holding my mangled arm in the air. I was twisted all the way around. Compound, that means the bone sticking out, friends. And I'm trying to get across the street to our house, so I'm screaming bloody murder, holding my mangled arm up for the traffic to see, to try to get through. I guess I was hoping that the traffic would magically part and I'd get across. But just then my dad came running out the door as I crossed the street. And I think dads and moms recognize the terrified screams of their own children, even through doors and walls and over the racket of traffic. In any event, Dad heard me, ran out, scooped me up in his arms, and drove me to the hospital. And I stayed there for a week with a cast from my wrist to my shoulder. Actually, the cast was on for a lot longer than a week, but I was in the hospital for a week. But if that wasn't bad enough, before the week is out, nurses wheeled my brother Mark in to the room, not as a visitor, but as a patient. So I'm sitting in there with my arm up in a cast and a sling and the whole deal, and then here comes Mark. Apparently he'd run out into traffic and got hit by a car. My poor mom and my poor dad. Actually, poor Mark. He was the one always getting busted up. And then a few years later, in the middle of a fight, Mark chased Dave up the porch and through the back door, and David, trying to evade capture, slammed the door behind him, blocking Mark's path. Mark kept going right through the glass in the top half of the back door. These are the kinds of things my poor dad had to put up with. Both of my brothers, Mark and David, had rabies shots. Back then they put that big long needle in your stomach because they both got bit by things. And Mark got only a few because the dog came up clean of rabies before Mark ran through the entire course of shots, but they never caught the mouse that bit Dave, so he got the full complement, nearly 20 rabies shots with that long needle. Bonnie got her toe torn up in the spokes of her bicycle. Susan, curious about how far she could ride her bike with her eyes closed, collided quickly with a mailbox and busted her two front teeth on the pole. This is sad. I mean, the fact is, each of us added to the misery of my dad's life in some measure. I no less than the others, though I think Mark shed the most blood. I guess that's part of the price that dads pay for being fathers, isn't it? And that's just part of the story, but I hope it's enough to let you know that I owe a lot to my dad. He was an intense man, a hard worker who took family and obligation and responsibility and leadership and fatherhood very seriously. And I learned a lot from him. Now, I suffered a lot under him, so I don't want to make this a Cinderella story. But I learned a lot from him, too. And it seems to me the things that I learned are having the longer impact on me than the things that I suffered. He taught me that I wasn't the center of the world. He taught me manners. He taught me respect for authority. He taught me the value of hard work and a job well done. He taught me that if you make your bed, you sleep in it. And if you want to dance, you have to pay the fiddler. Ever heard of those before? He taught me many lessons at his knee or over his knee, as the case may be, and oftentimes these lessons were punctuated with a willow switch. But my dad was also the first person who took me fishing, the first person who took me hunting, who taught me how to clean a rabbit and to tie a clinch knot, and how to leave a campsite just a little bit cleaner than when we found it. That was one of the rules. You leave, it's got to look better than when you got here. And I will tell you quite honestly, when I was young, I did not understand a lot of things about my dad. And that was hard. I didn't understand the decisions that he made, the way he did things. But he said, when you get older, you'll understand. You'll see that I'm right, and you'll thank me. And I didn't understand it then, like many things, but I do now. And as with so many things, now I know. And Dad, you are right. And Dad, thanks. And here's just a quick application for you, because this isn't just about me, it's about you. That's why I'm talking about this. I started thinking about the phrase, dads teach children. And I don't see that phrase as an imperative. Dad, you ought to teach children. I see it as an indicative. It's a simple statement of the way things are. Dads do teach their children, whether for good or for ill. And dads who are attentive and kind and virtuous teach their children. But dads who are inattentive and cruel and insensitive and impatient, they teach their children too. They just teach them something different. And that is a fact of life. Like father, like son. Kids inevitably become a chip off the old block in more ways than we'd like to admit. Isn't that true, dads? And you know, it's natural for kids to want to be like their pop. My daughter wants to help me with complicated tasks that I'm involved in. She doesn't even know what I'm doing. She just wants to get in there and start doing it with me. Kids want to be like their pop, especially if they're boys. It's natural to want to emulate your parents, dads in particular. So sooner or later, that is going to come home to roost, dads. As one comedian put it, there's a time in every man's life when he looks in the mirror, rubs his eyes, takes a second look, and says, Dad? That's it. They look in the mirror and they see their own father. And the fact is, all of us in many ways turn into our parents. And sometimes we learn from them what to emulate. Sometimes we learn what to avoid. Unfortunately, sometimes we learn to emulate what we should be avoiding. And that's kind of my lesson here. Kids pick things up. And I was able to learn good things that my dad taught me. And I was able to learn from the bad, too. And sometimes because I saw the bad and I tried to avoid it, other times I didn't avoid it. I had to have it corrected in my own life. And God's helping me to assess those things in our family life that shouldn't be repeated and to learn not by imitating but by avoiding. But I think every man has to frequently ask himself this question: what kind of pop am I being to my kids? Or if my kids were to grow up like me, would I be happy with that? I remember my friend Kathy's father, who is an alcoholic. And when she had her first child, he said this: I'm quitting. No more booze. I don't want my kid's kid to have a drunk for a grandfather. He realized what kind of model he was going to be. So maybe we ought to ask ourselves, what kind of father do our kids have? A drunk? An abuser? A liar? A thief? Someone who is insensitive or angry? Someone who is dishonest? Someone who is lazy? Someone who is a complainer? Or something better than that? Because one of these days, your kid is going to look in the mirror and rub his eyes and say, "Dad?" And what will he see when he does? That's my question on this Father's Day. Greg Kokel, 1-800-227-5278, lines wide open. And be glad to talk to you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. 1-800-227-5278 and the 714 area code 754-4150. Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
All right. Greg Kokel back with you. I got to chuckle because I actually really love this song from this movie. And it is a great rendition of an early Beatles kind of song, isn't it? Which is what it was meant to be. But I can't get it out of my head after I've heard it a couple of times. The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Greg Kokel, your host. And lines open, 1-800-227-5278, if you want to talk to me about anything on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Incidentally, my reflections from the first segment on Father's Day and my own dad. We're going to post those probably within the next 2 days on the website. So Melinda will get that going. Keep your eyes open at str.org if you'd like to have a copy of that that reflection. All right, let's go to our first caller and in Atlanta, Georgia. Dave, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you, Greg, for taking my call.
Sure. Glad to do so.
I was reading Matthew 22, verse 42 through 46, where Jesus basically posed a question to Pharisees.
Matthew 22, what verse is it, Matthew?
Matthew 22.
Okay.
Verses 42 through 46.
Okay. Go ahead. What's going on there?
And Jesus basically posed a question to the Pharisees. Says, what do you think of the Christ? Whose son is he? And they obviously said, okay, he's the son of David. And then Jesus turned around and said, okay, well, if he's the son of David, then how does David in the Spirit call him Lord, saying the Lord said, sit unto my Lord, sit down at thy right hand till I make thy enemies thy footstool.
Right.
So if...
Wait,
if
is that... Oh, that's Lord, Matthew 20. Are you looking... Okay, I'm sorry. I'm in the wrong passage. Now I got it. Okay, Matthew 22. All right, got it. Yes.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes. So basically, bottom line, Jesus asking, okay, they are... At that time, they obviously thought that he was, it seems like they just thought that the Messiah was just going to be a regular or ordinary man or whatever.
Correct,
because
yes.
When Jesus asked him, say, then how did David call him Lord? They couldn't answer him. So so it got me thinking, okay, I wonder what a Jew back in the days of King David or King Solomon expected or anticipated the Messiah to do or the Christ to do, and whatever that was. I'm wondering if in 2007, what does a Jew living today think the Messiah, that they're still expecting?
Right, sure. I'll tell you one thing about the Jew in the time of King David. He wouldn't have expected much, and the reason is there was almost, at that particular point in time, almost no revelation had been given about this person who would be the light to the Gentiles, or the blessing to the nation of a blessing from Abraham to the whole world. We have the first reference, I think, arguably, that could be made regarding Messiah in Genesis chapter 3, when it says that the seed of woman will bruise Satan on his head, but he himself will be bruised on his foot. But that's, you know, that's a very veiled reference, it appears. And then you have the promise of Abraham, Genesis chapter 12, the first three verses, that through Abraham all nations of the earth will be blessed, but no detail is given there. You have the Davidic covenant that is given during the time of David, that there would be a king that sits on the throne that would be a son of David's. And so you have that particular detail that after that there was awareness that this would be possibly the Messiah, certainly a king that was the son of David that would sit on the throne forever. This is part of God's promise to David. But you know what? There wasn't a whole lot more information after that. It wasn't until you get into the prophets and later history of Israel that you get more and more details. And even then, by the time Jesus himself appears, when John the Baptist identifies himself as the voice crying in the wilderness, make way straight the way of the Lord, even the details that have been given then are highly veiled, I guess is the best way to put it.
Okay.
And it's not until things start happening and things start being fulfilled that a lot of these things begin to come together. There seem to have been some fairly clear understandings, messianic expectations of the Jews, but we want to be careful that we don't make the messianic expectations of the Jews at the time of Jesus' coming to be, just because they were Jews in that time, to be the accurate and sound and appropriate expectations. This is exactly what Jesus was fighting against, wasn't it? They have these, a chicken in every pot and a portion in every garage kind of view of what the Messiah would bring. And when Jesus didn't fulfill that in the first half of his earthly ministry, they got uptight and they left. We see this at the end of John chapter 6. Jesus had a different plan first, and that was to be the suffering Messiah, not the conquering Messiah. And you certainly see intimations of this in the Hebrew Scriptures, but it isn't like written on a big billboard in plain language for everybody. One might wonder why God didn't do that, but it seems that he had good reasons. The fact is, though, it's more in retrospect that you can see all of these things coming together and pointing to Jesus of Nazareth as the Messiah that was promised, even though he didn't fulfill everything in his first coming. So I wouldn't expect any person around the time of David, certainly, which is 1,000 years before Christ, I wouldn't expect anyone to know much or have many expectations, apart from maybe some of the principles like Abraham or David who had special revelation from God. Jesus said, Abraham rejoiced to see my day and was glad in it. So, you know, there might have been some understanding there, but certainly not the rank and file in the scriptures that were handed down. Now, a Jew today has a different sense. First of all, most Jews are not religious of any sort, or many of them aren't.
If I could interrupt you a quick second, even before you go to, say, today's Jews in 2007.
Okay.
When back in the time when Jesus was on the earth at that point, then was it safe to say that they perhaps that the Pharisees at the time perhaps were thinking that the Messiah was going to be like an earthly king to get rid of the Romans and reestablish the kingdom?
Yes, that's right, and they believe that for a good reason because those kinds of things were promised regarding the Messiah. In fact, when I talk with my friend Dennis Prager about who is a religious Jew. About Jesus as Messiah, he's got a very standard refutation for the idea that Jesus is Messiah. When Messiah comes, there'll be world peace. There isn't world peace, therefore the Messiah hasn't come. That's his thinking. And I understand his reasoning. The problem is he only has part of the picture. The purpose of Messiah was not simply to bring world peace. It was also to provide the foundations for peace with God and to be the rescuer and the savior. And that's why when the Messiah came first, he came as a suffering Messiah. We see this in Isaiah 53. And when he comes the second time, he will come as the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And establish the kind of kingdom that the Jews had come to expect based on the prophecies. I think that most Jews today, they read Moses, and as Paul says, those religious Jews. Many Jews are not religious of any stripe. Okay, and many of them are atheists, total secularists. But those who are religious, now to some outsiders, I realize this is going to sound like a cop-out, but I'm just going to tell you what Paul says. When Jews read the law, there is a veil over their eyes. They do not see the full picture. And when they finally turn to Christ, the veil is lifted and they begin to understand. That's what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and 4. But the fact is, and I have friends who are strongly committed Jews, and I will tell you quite honestly what it seems like to me as I explain the things and they just don't get it. And sometimes I think, well, I'm not doing a good job at explaining it, but I'm better than most, I think, and it's like the change doesn't fall into the meter for them. And I can understand why there is a kind of a judicial blindness, and I don't mind that. I don't mean that in a condescending way. It just seems to be the way Paul explains why the Jews largely have not responded to Jesus as their Messiah, though there is good reason for that. Since there are a lot of Jews that are not religious, or those who are religious are reformed, a reform in conviction, or liberals basically. When it comes to religious issues, they are not looking for a Messiah. Those who are looking for a Messiah are using the Old Testament as a guide, but they are also looking for a political deliverer, largely. I don't have a sense that they're looking for a spiritual savior, and Jesus wants to do both.
A political deliverer. I mean, for our practical purposes, I mean, look at Israel today. I mean, they don't need a so-called political deliverer. They're always at war, but in the sense they can take care of them. They can handle themselves.
That's the secularists. The secular Jews think they can handle themselves, and they actually are quite capable. I think what they don't realize is that God's helping them out, and they don't always give them credit. But the religious Jews, though, understand that they are to be delivered not just from the Gentiles, but also from the secular Jews themselves. And they're holding out to try to be faithful, the Hasidim, you know, the deeply religious Hasidic Jews are holding out. And there are different opinions about how the Messianic thing will work out, but they are committed largely to a Messianic vision where the secular Jew is not, or the liberal religious Jew is not. So that's the best I can do with giving you a sense of where these guys are at right now.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that because I was just been thinking about them. And
one of the best
reading that scripture.
Dave, I would suggest that you find a Hasidic Jew, look, a religious Jew, and ask him his opinion. Just tell him you're very interested. You're a Gentile, and you have a lot of respect for the Hebrew scriptures. Don't call it the Old Testament, because that's kind of a pejorative way of putting it when you're talking to a Jewish person. Just say the Hebrew scriptures, you have a lot of respect for them. They form the foundation of your own tradition as a Christian, and you're interested in their point of view. You just wonder, okay, what is their view. And be sure you ask questions and don't sandbag and jump in on them. And I mean, if you're going to share Christ with them, then tell them that's what your interest is. But if you ask them, you're just going to get information, and then you kind of bait and switch kind of thing, then that would be offensive to them.
Yeah.
So, but it's just great to talk to some of these folks just to get an education. I said, I have no agenda. Just tell me what you really think. I'd like to ponder it.
Okay,
and that's the best person to talk to, not me.
Okay, I see. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So the Hasidic Jews, those are the one that would be considered the religious Jews.
The most religious, yes. And you can recognize them by the way they dress. They don't cut the hair along the sides of their ears. You know, they have prayer beads, clothing that kind of identifies them as really conservative Jews. They dress in black. They wear these hats. And not all of them do, but I'm just saying these are some of the things you'll notice. And if you approach them, you know, just kind of out of the blue, if you're not careful and gentle, it might seem abrupt to them or whatever, because they are really part of their own community. And so I would definitely talk with them, but express your interest in learning some more about that, and wondered, and just ask them, can you ask them some questions? Would they mind answering some questions about Judaism? And then take it from there. All righty?
I appreciate it, Greg.
Okay, Dave, I appreciate the call. I hope that's helpful to you. Let's go to Wilmington. Oh, we got to take a break now? Okay, Preston, we'll get you in just a moment in Wilmington, California. And we'll do that when we return here on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday, 3 until 5. Show a Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. 1-800-227-5278. Did my voice just crack? If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150.
And let's go to Wilmington, California, and Preston. Welcome to the show, Preston.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Now and then I hear Roman Catholics, when they're talking to Protestants, they say, quote, "We were first." And given the context in which they say that, I'm sure they mean to say we're the most authentic form of Christianity because we were first.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you respond to that when they hear somebody say that?
Well, okay, when they say we, they mean what?
Roman Catholicism.
Okay, Roman Catholicism. Roman Catholicism. Means, Catholic means universal. That's a universal church.
The church in Rome.
Rome. Okay, Rome. Rome is a city where a bishop resided who was one of the major bishops of the early church. So they would say that the church that was governed by the universal church that was governed by the bishop from Rome, who has come to be known as the Pope, this is the first church.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question. Do you know anything at all about the early church? Have you read the book of Acts?
I read in Jerusalem, Day of Pentecost, and then...
Okay, you read the book of Acts, right?
Huh?
You read the book of Acts, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the early church, was the early church based in Rome?
No, but...
The early church was based in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And also had leadership in Antioch.
Yeah, yeah.
So the first church was not the Roman Catholic Church.
I don't see what... I heard William Bennett say this, and... He's supposed to be well-read. How could he...
Well, it's just the Roman Catholic line. This is what they say. I'm offering you a line of thinking. If the Roman Catholic...
I know it's baloney, but I...
Yeah, well, see, this is what...
That is baloney.
You ask me, what do you say to him? And I'm saying, here's what you say.
Baloney.
You say the Roman Catholic Church is the universal church that was... it looks to Rome for its leadership. And that church... The universal group of Christians that looked to Rome for its leadership was the first church. This is false. It's false. The first church was in Jerusalem.
Correct.
So then the Roman Catholic Church is not the first church.
So how do you explain people like William Bennett say we were first?
Well, I can't explain why they say that they were first when it's obvious that they weren't first. I mean, strictly speaking, now they want to take all of it. Look, Roman Catholics want to say it was all theirs. I understand this. It's different to demonstrate that that's the case. The early church did not look to Rome for its leadership. In fact, it didn't even look to Jerusalem for its leadership. And you think about it, it certainly didn't look to Peter. In the records that we have in the book of Acts, we have Peter playing a prominent role early on. No question about that. He was one of the top three disciples, Peter, James, and John.
Correct.
And he was the spokesperson for the group, largely put, initially. Okay, that changed very quickly because when the Jerusalem Council met, and we see the record of this in Acts chapter 15, we do not see Peter presiding from Rome. We see James presiding from Jerusalem in the first great council of the church. We don't see anybody speaking ex cathedra. That is, I'm sitting in the chair of Christ, and therefore I speak for Christ, and I'm going to tell you how it is. No, they see the group of the leadership, the corporate leadership, that are discussing what God has been doing, and Paul had a major voice there. So you see James that draws it all together, and he doesn't speak with authority as an individual. He simply... is one of the leaders of the group, and he speaks for the group as they draw this document together as to how they're going to deal with the crisis there in the Galatian crisis, this first heresy. Do we mix the law with faith? And the answer is no, we don't. And then they send that out. Peter's not prominent. It is rather James. Peter, incidentally, was part of the Galatian problem. And we read this in the early chapters of the book of Galatians, where Paul writes that he had to oppose Peter openly because he was living in hypocrisy and he was contributing to this problem. So if reading the book of Acts, if we get the idea of anybody leading the church, it's either James out of Jerusalem or Paul implicitly leading the church as the chief of the apostles, because he's writing the most scripture, and the storyline moves from Peter and Jerusalem to Paul and the mission field. And so implicitly we see this this shifting. So if you're dealing with the biblical texts, you don't see the Roman Catholic Church in play early on. In fact, you don't even see that for the first 350 years. The next big council was the Council of Nicaea, 325. Okay? In 325, you have all of these guys meeting, all of these bishops, 318 representatives that are meeting there in Nicaea to have this council to deal with this problem of the Arius and the issue of the deity of Christ and all of that. So what does Rome have to say about this? Rome sends two, that is the bishop in Rome, who is either Sylvester or Silvanus, I get them mixed up. The bishop of Rome sent two representatives, just like every other part of the region sent two representatives to have a voice in this larger thing. The bishop of Rome was not the leader of this. Constantine called it, and it was Eusebius and Athanasius and Arius that were the main players there. So you don't see this like Rome in charge for the first 300 or 400 years, and they were there first. This is nonsense. Every follower of Jesus Christ can easily claim those first 400 years as his spiritual forebears. There was no Roman Catholic Church then. This is a fiction of history. There was no Roman Catholic Church. And it wasn't until later that Rome, as a bishop, gained political ascendancy. And that through quite a bit of chicanery. Now people want to say, oh yeah, well, Peter was the first pope. Okay, where do you – and then he just passed the popage on to people who followed him. Well, we don't have a – the book of Acts certainly doesn't indicate that. And they get Peter the first pope from this idea that this is – upon this rock I will build my church. But that's making that verse do a whole lot of work. If Jesus intended that verse to mean that Peter's in charge and he takes over for Jesus, and then everybody that follows Peter takes over in the same way, so it's just like having Jesus here on earth, but here in a human form, a different human form, that is in the form of the Pope, the authority of Jesus follows them. Why did Jesus say anything like this? You see, I don't think that Jesus came to build an organization, Preston. And if Jesus didn't come to build an organization, then it doesn't make sense to ask which organization is the right one. So when Roman Catholics say we're the true church, I say that's nonsense, because the church is not an organization. And the Roman Catholic Church was not Roman Catholic until the Roman bishop gained power over everybody else, and that was long into the process, certainly past the Council of Nicaea. You don't see any of that stuff in play early on. And so I think it's a big mistake to claim for it's historical hubris, arrogance, for Rome to make the claim like that on all the fathers and all the founders and all the apostles and all that other stuff. And even if the person who's making the claim is somebody as august as Bill Bennett, as bright as he is, I still think he's mistaken. And I just gave you the evidence. Look at the book of Acts. You see nothing like this. Look at the Council of Nicaea.
I just don't know why he doesn't read it and come to the same conclusion.
Well, because I'll tell you why. And this is not, I'm just being descriptive here. I'm not being condescending. It's because he's a Roman Catholic. He's been told this is what he's to believe, and he's been socialized to hold this view, and now he's got to defend it because he views the Roman Catholic Church as the true church. But if you have an unbiased assessment of the facts, you're not going to find Rome in its ascendancy until much, much later. Much, much later. So there was no Roman Catholic Church in the first century. Sorry, just wasn't happening. And that's contrary to evidence. And I'm going to go back to the book of Acts as my main source on this one.
I have that book, by Lorraine Bittner. Roman Catholicism?
Yeah, he's a Reform thinker, and he's pretty aggressive against Roman Catholicism. I don't know what his book about Roman Catholicism actually teaches, so I don't know if it's good or bad. He certainly has a point of view, and you have to keep that in mind when you read it. But I have a point of view too, but I'm just giving you – here. You followed my rationale, I hope, in the book of Acts, and so I think this is compelling. And I have no reason to believe otherwise when I hear the claims of Roman Catholic apologists. Okay?
Okay.
Good talking to you, Preston. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Sarah. Let me see if I can find the number here. Sarah, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hello.
Hello, Sarah. How are you doing today?
Oh, I was enjoying hearing you, and you had to be the one that made me think back. I'm 85 now.
Uh-huh.
And you're in the very same area that I was brought up in.
Oh, is that right? Northern, the northern part of, the, of Chicago proper?
Yes, in Chicago. I was born in DeKalb, which was 60 miles out.
Yes, uh-huh.
I came to Chicago when I was a year old.
Oh, no kidding. I actually went to college in DeKalb at Northern Illinois University back in 1969 and 70.
My mother's brother did more of the landscaping there. And
oh, is that right?
I remember as a child those beautiful buildings that are there no more.
Uh-huh.
But it was like living back there all over again, hearing you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I have more stories to tell about Chicago proper, but I just have this vivid picture of the far north side there, Rogers Park, Pottawatomie Park, the train tracks there that we used to walk along, going out to Clark Street to go to the Adelphi Theater there, and being raised at St. Jerome's there my first couple of years as a as a student in their kindergarten and then in first, second, third grade.
You
and then
Chicago River, where the Riverview Park, the rides would go down. You'd think you were going right into the river.
I know. Yeah, it was amazing. That was scary. So you remember Riverview as well?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
I lived not, well, as if you were a teenager, you could have walked there from where I lived.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
If you knew where California Avenue was.
I don't remember that, except for the California Avenue out here in California, but no, not in the Chicago area.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, Riverview was kind of like a great fantasy land for young people. You know, you saved your nickels and dimes so you could just go to Riverview. And I guess it's the way kids think of Disneyland now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
they'd drop them off. In those days, it wasn't so dangerous.
Yes, that's right. And do you remember the Bobs, of course, which is the most storied roller coaster there? But that under when you went in and you paid and you got your ticket and you got in line,
mm-hmm.
next to where the line was going in to, you know, get onto the Bobs,
uh-huh.
they had a huge table or a large table that was an absolute mound. A huge mound of, believe it or not, earrings.
No, I don't remember that.
Well, the women used to wear the clip-on earrings. Remember that?
Well, I do.
Yeah, you still do. I mean,
I
they would have pierced
that.
Ears, too, but a lot of them wore the clip-on earrings. And so when people went to things like Riverview, even then they would get dressed up. You know, they'd gussy up a little bit, and the women would wear their earrings, okay? Uh-huh. And what would happen is they wear these clip-on earrings, and then they get into the Bobs. And when the Bobs took them for a turn... Right, and
it
tossed them to and fro, those earrings would go flying through the air, and they'd land up on the ground and down in the workings and whatever.
Right.
And so the maintenance people would collect them and just add them to the pile.
Yeah.
And so then you'd walk by, and here is this massive pile of earrings that they'd collected over the many, many years.
Yeah.
And now there was a sign over that, and it said, no two earrings match. Now, I don't believe that for a second, do you?
Well, I don't know.
Well, they would have to check every earring every time they find a new one. They'd have to go through the whole pile and look for a match, right? And I didn't think they actually did that, but it was a clever little ploy.
You were familiar with the my education was there until I finally was given a scholarship to the Art Institute, but it wasn't
really?
I wanted. So I dropped that, and I went and did my career type that I was trained for, and it was right across the street from the Art Institute.
Well, you turned down a scholarship to the Art Institute in Chicago?
I did.
Unbelievable. Well,
I didn't like the kind that they were teaching at the time. It wasn't the kind that I was wanting to have a career.
Oh, I see. Well, you were looking for a career at that time, but that you must have been quite talented to be able to receive a scholarship at the Art Institute.
But I was living back there again, hearing you talk about it. You know Wacker and Michigan Avenue.
Yes, uh-huh, yeah.
Well, when I was older and had the World War II came on,
uh-huh,
and I'm sorry, but I had a sad first marriage, and
uh-huh.
I was heartbroken.
Uh-huh.
And so then I worked across from the Wrigley Building on Wacker
Drive. Right, uh-huh. Right, right.
And
uh-huh.
then you could see the Tribune Tower.
Yes, of course. Uh-huh. That in the near north side, right.
Right. Yeah. And when we didn't like the kind of model they had at the classes, we'd take our drawing boards and go down to the Field Museum. You heard of that?
Sure, of course. Yeah,
and
just
it was along the lake. And yes. My mother at that time, she said, you're going to freeze.
I spent many hours at the Field Museum of Natural History there in Chicago.
Me too. And the Shedd Aquarium and the Planetarium.
Sure. All right there.
All right there.
Yeah, it was great. I had many school field trips to all of those places as a kid. It was great reflecting and remembering back on those things with you, Sarah. Thank you so much for the call. And God keep you, dear. 85 years old in Chicago, remembers the old days. All right. Greg Kokel here with hour number two just ahead. Stay with us and stand to reason.
Are you talking to me?
All right, hour number two here at Stand to Reason. This is Greg Kokel, and this show is your place for straightforward, no frills, nothing buttery, real, believable Christianity. That's what I try to bring you every Sunday from 3 until 5. And I'm glad you've joined us. If you missed the first hour, since this is Father's Day, and my best to the dads out there, I talked a little bit about my own dad and the price he paid for being the dad of the five Kokel kids, at least part of the price he paid for being our dad, and some of my reflections on that. Please podcast the show and get the first hour and listen to that. I think that it'll be encouraging to you. It tells you a little bit about me, but it also, I think, it'll be encouraging to you as a dad yourself or as any kind of parent, quite frankly. We are going to have this transcribed and placed on the web, and I think we'll just title it Dad, and it'll be sometime midweek that'll be available. Just keep your eyes open for it. str.org is the location. I am not the kind of person that sends out internet jokes or internet human interest pieces. I really dislike those things. It's not because sometimes they're not valuable or they're not funny, but I find them a profound waste of time. Although it does seem, and this amazes me, that there are millions of people who have nothing better to do, it seems to me, than pass these things around. So I am not inclined to send these things out. If somebody sends them to me, I throw them away generally. And if I get them consistently from somebody, I have a letter that I send them. I saved it in a file and I paste it in and say, you know, please, thanks, I appreciate it, but I don't have time for this, so please don't send me these anymore. Now, the only people that I actually get those things from anymore members of my staff, and I actually made an exception on, I guess it was Thursday, about a piece that was sent to me. It was a video clip from YouTube that I have to tell you was the most touching thing that I have ever seen on the internet, and broke my rule, as it were, and let's make this an exception to the rule, and I penned a short note, and I said, this isn't a joke, you won't be sorry, this is not for laughs, get your hanky. And I sent it out to a whole bunch of people that I know. And the reason I did is because it captured an incredibly sublime moment. And I'll tell you what it is in just a moment where you can get this, but I want to make an observation about something that C.S. Lewis said. Lewis talked about joy. He had a very particular and maybe even peculiar definition of that word. For him, if I understood him correctly, joy was when you touched something transcendent. And you had a little bit of a taste of what, how could I put this, what life was meant to be in God's mind. A little taste of the eternal, a little taste of perfection, a little taste of glory, however you want to put it. And he thought that God, you know, placed these things within our reach at different moments so we'd get a little glimpse of something much bigger and better than what we have. And that there's a hunger that we have for those kinds of transcendent moments. And that hunger is rarely satisfied in this world. In fact, it's never satisfied in this world. It can only be teased. There's a down payment of sorts. There's an earnest of sorts that we get a taste of it, a touch of it. And this gives us glimpses of eternity. And Lewis was a Platonist. He was influenced by Plato, and so he believed this was the Shadowlands, the place of the perfect things was heaven, the more real thing. And we got little touches of that here and there. But in the future with God, we will get the real McCoy, as it were. And there were art and stories, myth. These were all means of helping us get in touch with that perfection. In fact, this was a great argument for him for the existence of heaven and for the truth of Christianity. He called it the argument from desire, because we have this desire for these things. We have a desire for joy, and it's a desire that's innate in all of us, and we never have it quite satisfied. But we get tastes of it every once in a while, and since it's a hunger we have that's not satisfied in this life, then there must be a place for its satisfaction that must be in the life to come. Because in principle, all hungers, all appetites have satisfactions, is his argument. Now, I think it's an interesting argument. It had tremendous currency for him. But I don't want you to think so much about the apologetic aspect of the argument as much as I want you to think about the observation and the insight that Lewis had about life there. That aren't there these moments when we just touch something that's beyond us? We touch something that is profound and virtuous and good and beautiful and transcendent and fine. And when this happens for me, I get choked up. Now, I've told you before that I cry at a lot more movies than my wife does, or a lot more things. It's not that she's hard-hearted. She's not at all. And if you know her, you know what I mean. But she's tender-hearted. But I'm the one who starts blubbering faster at these kinds of things. And it is always a very sweet thing for me to be able to have those moments of joy, at least the way Lewis characterized it. And the other day, when I followed the link that the enforcer sent me, I had one of those moments. And it was a sublime moment based on something very beautiful, but it was beautiful in a number of different dimensions. Now, many of you are aware of this TV show, which I don't watch, but I know is really popular, American Idol. And this is where people who aspire to greatness or think that they have a chance at greatness, even if they don't, trot out onto the stage and show their wares, usually singing. Is that right? Isn't that what that is? So they sing. And they do their thing, and it's generally a pop deal. And then they have a couple of judges, and one of them is Simon Cowell, a Brit, who is particularly obnoxious and honest to a fault, even to being cruel, from what I understand. Very, very hard to please. And so sometimes when you have these people that have no talent, and some people who try out for this know that, others don't know it. They're simple people. And they just think they may have something, and they go out and they don't have talent, but they have the courage to step up. Well, these people get mowed down by people like Simon Cowell and the other judges on the panel. And this is a place where people can phone in and vote. And sometimes the popular vote overwhelms the vote of the panel, who are the specialists and the pros and whatever, and people become infamous because of their little turn on American Idol, because they pleased the audience and not just pleased the pros, who may not have had nice things to say about them. Some of you might remember were a young man who had Down syndrome. It was an Asian person who was really bad, but everybody really liked him, and they kind of sided with him. In any event, these things happen. There are crowd pleasers. Well, Britain has its version of the American Idol. It's called Britain's Got Talent. And the clip that was sent to me by the Enforcer was of a young man who is a mobile phone salesman. And he was about the most ordinary-looking guy you can imagine. And I'm just going to describe this scene for you. I want you to go find it and watch it if you can, because I guarantee you, because some people didn't like it. But if you go to Melinda's blog from a couple of days ago, you'll find the link. Because this man walks stiffly out onto stage. He's a bit portly. His hair is buzzed. He's got a bad haircut. And he's got a cheap suit. It's something he bought from a store that's basically your Walmart of the UK. And the woman, one of the panelists, asks, well, what are you going to do? His name is Paul Potts, by the way. Paul, what are you going to do? And he says, I'd like to sing opera. Well, the two men on either side, the other two judges, they're rolling their eyes. Okay. All right. And Simon Cowell says, okay, let's have it. Do your thing. Paul Potts nods to the technician. She pushes a button. The music rolls. And then something absolutely magical happens. Now, most of you probably are not opera fans, but there is an aria for tenors that is called Nessun Dorma, Nessun Dorma. It's an Italian phrase. It means no one sleeps. It's an aria from an opera called Turandot, and it is one that I'm especially fond of, as it turns out. I'm not really an opera geek, but I like arias, and both from tenors and sopranos, and this is one of my favorites. It turns out to be it has tremendous pathos to it. That is, there's a lot of emotion, and it's not easy to sing, and it really plays off of very aggressive high notes of tenors. So it's a showcase for a good voice. And Paul Potts opened his mouth and began to sing this beautiful piece. And I'm telling you, it was a transcendent moment. Now, I do not mean that Paul Potts was able to sing like Pavarotti. He doesn't have Pavarotti's voice, but he doesn't have a car phone salesman's voice either. And what was so touching is, as you're hearing this man release with tremendous skill, capability, control, and more than anything else, absolute pathos from the heart. This man is feeling every single note. He captures the audience by surprise. He blows them away. People start weeping. The audience starts clapping before he's even finished. Simon Cowell is sitting there with his mouth gaping open. And Paul Potts finishes with this powerful ending, this great crescendo at the heights of the tenor range. And when he's done, the audience absolutely explodes. And the female, I don't know who she is. She's an actress who's on the panel. The one woman, she's crying. She doesn't know what to do with this. Simon Cowell says, I did not expect that. You're a car phone salesman and you do this. It was unbelievable. This was a quarterfinal round. They had not heard him before. He advanced to the semis and he has since advanced to the finals. And I won't tell you the end of the story because you'll have to find that out yourself on the internet. But I hope that you follow Melinda's lead. go to her post, or you can just go to my YouTube, and type in Paul Potts, P-O-T-T-S, and you'll get his semifinal performance. That's the one to watch. This is when he opens up. Because you see an ordinary person, a very vulnerable person, even a drab person, who's got crooked teeth, for goodness sake, and a bad haircut, and a magnificent voice. And it is so sweet and touching to see this simple, humble person with this great gift of God that has up to now been unnoticed and undiscovered, to stand in front of these smirking, eye-rolling professionals and leave them speechless and leave the audience in tears. It is a moment of supreme goodness that I encourage you to enjoy and completely savor, and you'll find that at YouTube, Paul Potts, the semifinal performance of Nessun Dorma, and you can get the connection there at str.org on Melinda's blog. What's the title? What's the lead to that blog? What's the title? Is something like A Phone Salesman Makes Good, or A Dream Fulfilled, or something like that? Yes. Okay. So I invite you to enjoy that. Shall we go to break right now? No. Okay, we don't need to do that. Let's go to Rick in West Covina. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Rick.
Hi, Greg. It's a pleasure to finally talk to you.
Thank you.
First of all, I just wanted to say thanks for all the work you did. And NPR has been a major influence in my life and some other people that I know.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm glad to hear that.
Okay, good. Let me ask the question that I had. Me and my fiance were discussing this issue, and we wanted to hear what you had to say on it. Both of us are Christians, believers, and we were invited by a family member to go to a gay wedding.
Mm-hmm.
Person is gay, and they were, or not a wedding, but some type of event to make this partnership. I guess.
Right, right. It's a wedding. Sure.
Yeah.
It is. Right. It's not a licensed. The government isn't licensing it in a sense, but it certainly is a wedding, which shows that gays can get married, and they do so all the time.
Right, right, right. So it is a wedding in most sense of the word, and we were invited, and we were wondering if it would be appropriate or immoral, at worst, for two Christians to attend this event, which most Christians do view marriage as one of the most sacred things that we can do as a Christian. So we just wanted to hear your take on whether or not it would be appropriate for us to attend, keeping in mind that these are family members that are getting married. So
Okay. Well, I'll tell you, Rick, this is a hard one. I'm just going to mention it right up front. And the reason it's hard is because there are, in some ways, I think, conflicting moral concerns, all right?
Right?
On the one hand, Paul makes it clear in in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 that we are to not to judge those who are in the world. Now, this doesn't mean we can't make judgments about moral behavior that non-Christians have, okay? That we're somehow foreclosed on saying that certain behaviors are wrong. We can make judgments about behaviors, but we are not to treat non-Christians in a judgmental way because we don't expect them to live like Christians when they're not.
Mm-hmm.
We are to expect Christians to live like Christians and hold them accountable, but not the world. And in fact, Paul says, I told you not to associate with immoral people. He says this in 1 Corinthians 5. He said, but I didn't mean the immoral people of the world, because then you'd have to go out of the world, and you're supposed to go into the world, not out of the world. You see, you're supposed to be in the world, but not of it. So, you know, I didn't mean that you should not associate it with immoral people.
Mm-hmm.
I told you don't associate with immoral people in the church, not in the world. And so we've sometimes got it the opposite. We kind of eschew engagement with immoral people in the world, but then we'll hang around with a bunch of awful folks in the church, and
right.
we let them carry on. That's exactly the opposite of what Paul had in mind. So here is one ethic here. Here is a moral principle being taught here, that we are not to be judgmental and condescending of people who do not live by our standards because they're not one of us.
Right.
You know, even though their behavior is wrong, we are not judgmental about that. And we are not to separate ourselves from them, because we are to be in the world and in helping to be a force of light in that darkness, okay? That's one principle. I want you to hold on just a second here, because I'm over time for a break. So,
okay.
Rick, when I come back, I will speak to you about the competing principle, and we'll talk a little bit about how this might work out, okay? Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Don't go away, ladies and gentlemen.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Greg Kokel back with you here in a kind of a classical moment. You know, we used to have a classic moment many, many years ago when I did live radio for KBRT as one of their employees. We did Saturday and Sunday, and we used to have, when I just come onto something really sublime, we'd play it. That was Christopher Parkening with Bach and his guitar, a Christian man, both actually, Christian men. My congratulations to Drew Morgan. Drew is the winner of our Frapper, in a sense, contest, I guess his drawing is better. Drew is from Northridge, California, and the Frapper is a map where you can actually kind of plant a flag or indicate that you are, you know, part of the listening audience of Stand to Reason. And if you go to our website at str.org and the lower left-hand corner, hit the podcast link, and it'll take you to that site, and you can register as a listener. You become formally part of our listening community. And then from that list of registered people, we draw a name every week, and we give them a free product at Stand to Reason, oftentimes a relativism book or maybe the Tactics DVD or something like that. So the gift this week goes to Drew Morgan in Northridge, California, and congratulations, Drew. Let's go back to Rick in West Covina, California. And, Rick, we're talking about whether or not it's okay, morally speaking, for you as a follower of Christ to attend a homosexual wedding.
Right.
And I said that this is kind of a challenging question because there seem to be conflicting ethics that are involved. And the first ethic is one that we are not to be judgmental of non-believers. but rather we are to be hang out with them and use those opportunities, excuse me, to bring light into their life. There's another ethic, too, I think, that's in play here. And so let me ask you a question, and this is where I have trouble. I think I know what I'm going to recommend, but let me just give you at least the other side.
Okay.
The other side is, why is it that people go to a wedding?
One reason why would be to confirm what's taking place or to act as a witness.
Yes.
To the wedding. So for the
right.
people who are getting married, the guests would be, I guess, like witnesses to help keep the two together forever and ever.
Right. They're not hostile witnesses. They are positive witnesses.
Right.
They are there that go. They are members of your community that show up to, one, celebrate, to affirm and confirm and help to continue. That is, this is a kind of accountability group here.
Exactly.
That we are saying when people get married in a big festival there, they have a big celebration. And this is why I believe in these public celebrations and not just living together kind of thing, is because the community is affirming this. They're getting behind it. They are throwing their lot in with you. They are partnering with you in a certain kind of sense. They are giving gifts and rewarding you for your decision. They are assisting that couple in getting started into their new life. Steve Wagner from Stand to Reason just got married a few weeks ago. And we have, this was a big celebration for all of us. We were thrilled to see Steve and Rebecca get married, and those who were able to go to the wedding went to fulfill all of those purposes that you and I have just described for weddings. Now, here's my question. Do you underwrite any of those concerns personally with regards to the couple that's getting married?
Yeah, I have concerns with all of them.
No. I wasn't clear. I said, do you underwrite those concerns? In other words, do you approve of them? Are you going to the wedding for the purpose of approving the relationship, encouraging the relationship, celebrating the relationship, and trying to be a member of the community that's going to help make their relationship survive?
Oh, and in that case, clearly not.
Okay, so then what would be the reason that you would go to the wedding, when being there at the wedding implicitly results in your affirmation of all those areas that you do not, in fact, affirm, but indeed feel just the opposite about.
And that's exactly what the point where we read, and we're asking, well, do we even what at least one reason why we should go? And the only thing we can think of is because we're family and because we love them, of course, as people. And
well, you can still love them as people.
Right.
Without celebrating this relationship in the way that weddings celebrate the relationship.
Of course.
So I realize you're getting heat from other family members on this. By the way, how close a family member is this?
This is my fiancé's brother.
Okay, that's pretty close. And I realize you're going to get all kinds of heat from other family members. And if you choose not to go, it's going to get a lot worse. In fact, you have to consider this, the relationships may not recover.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the reason why. And you can tell me I or nay on this if this is what's going on. But I think that most Christians in your situation will adopt a live and let live attitude as long as they're forced not to celebrate that relationship. But unless you celebrate the relationship, the other party will not allow any relationship with them to continue at all. And so they will break off the relationship because you don't affirm what they're doing, and they're going to make it your fault. And they're going to call it you being hateful and spiteful and angry and condescending and not being loving. But they are the ones that are going to create the rift in the relationship. They're going to exclude you. You won't be excluding them. This is not the kind of group that you could say, you know what, I love you, brother or brother-in-law, or brother-in-law-to-be in your case. We love you. But we cannot, in good conscience, affirm, support, celebrate something that we think is wrong. So we are not going to attend the celebration for those reasons. This is not a group that's going to say to you, well, you know what? I respect your conscience on this issue. It isn't the decision I'd make, but I respect your choice. I'm very tolerant of your alternate point of view. No way. They're not going to do that because they don't believe that. They are not a tolerant group. And not only will the brother and his lover, my suspicion is, not only will they react that way to you, but I suspect a bunch of the other family members are going to react that way to you as well. And even if they are followers of Christ, they're going to be putting the pressure on you guys, who are the Christians, not the pressure on the person who's living their lives as an affront to God. So, I mean, does this sound familiar? Any of these things that I'm talking about?
Yeah, because we've heard you talk on other issues concerning how we should react to non-Christians concerning morality. And we've heard you say that we shouldn't judge them and act and expect them to act like Christians.
Right.
And we've agreed with that. And you said that don't endorse any of those things like celebrating marriage or trying to keep them accountable throughout their lifetime, then there really is no reason for us to go to the ceremony.
Yeah, I agree. And so that's what I would do. I wouldn't go. And I would make it, I would explain it graciously to the family members and to the brother and his lover or partner, however you want to call him, and say, you know, we in good conscience, it sounds like I just lost Rick, but I know, Rick, you can still listen on the, you're in West Covina? Yeah, you can still listen on the show. So I'm going to unplug you because I'm going to get the diatone in just a moment, but Rick, if I were you, I wouldn't go. I would explain to the people involved, the principals, and the rest of the family members that, out of good conscience as a Christian before God, you cannot do this. You love them. You want to be kind and gracious to them insofar as possible, but you cannot participate in a way that would compromise your conscience. And celebrating, going to a wedding would affirm all kinds of things, the things we discussed, that you simply cannot affirm in good conscience as a follower of Christ. Now, be prepared for no one to respect your decision. I mean no one. Be prepared for, obviously, the principals involved not to respect it. Be prepared for the parents not to respect it. And all the other players. In fact, I'd be surprised if anyone did. But what this shows is that they are dishonest. These are the people that are always talking about tolerance and love and acceptance. And what are they doing? The minute that you won't play by their rules, then they will not tolerate or respect you. Even when you say, it's a matter of personal conscience, I could be completely wrong in this, but here I stand, I can do no other. They will not respect it. Now, in your case, I don't know your family. I don't know the people. I could be totally surprised, but I would be so totally surprised, to put it simply. This is not the way it usually goes. Usually it goes the other way. Small-minded, it's my way or the highway. All right? And then you have to make your peace with that. So God bless you in this, and I hope things go well, but that's what I would do. All right, let's go. Let me look at the clock here. Okay, we got some more time. Let me go to Fallbrook and Greg in Fallbrook, California. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
Hi, Greg.
I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I downloaded and listened to your teaching on the decision-making and the will of God.
Uh-huh.
And I've read Gary Friesen's book about
Yes. A very good book.
Yeah.
It's a thick one because he actually exegetes passages. He just doesn't proof text
right.
And tell stories.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's brought up a lot of questions.
Sure.
And I wanted to ask you
I'm not surprised.
So here's the question I have. Assuming that the wisdom view is true and that we cannot expect to hear from God through messages and, you know, other things.
Uh-huh.
Then how is it possible to have a relationship with God? Or what does that relationship look like?
Okay, let me bring the rest of the listeners up to speed. What I've done in this tape, in this teaching called Decision Making in the Will of God, and it really reflects the point of view of Gary Friesen in his book by the same title, that's why the name was mentioned, is to take exception with the received tradition in the church that God makes our decisions for us, and that's called the will of God or the blueprint idea. That is, here's what God has decided he wants for us, marriage, profession, schools, big decisions, small decisions, whatever. And our goal is to try to squeeze that information out of God, get him to tell us what he wants us to do, and then we'll do it. And that's called finding the will of God. I think that that model is completely misguided. There is no support for such a model in the scriptures. And instead, I argue in the material that you studied that that the decision, the model for decision-making, which might be called the wisdom model, is that we are to do what is morally allowed and what is wise and what's the word I'm looking for? Doesn't waste a whole lot of time. What's the word I'm looking for? In any event, these are the kinds of things. You don't sit around doing nothing, waiting for some God to speak. You redeem the time because the days are evil. And you do what is wise and what is morally sound, and that's the way you make decisions. And if God wants to intervene, fine. But there is no biblical teaching that God makes the decisions for us, and we got to squeeze the information out of him before we can decide what we want to do with our lives once we find out what he wants us to do with our lives. So now the question is comes up, well, then what does a relationship with God look like? Now, I always think this is an odd question, and I'm not putting you down, Greg, because I know this comes up on a regular basis, but all that I have said with regards to our relationship with God in the decision-making material is that I don't think the Bible teaches that God makes our decisions to us, and then for us rather, and then puts the decisions that he's made in cipher and code that we then have to figure out. And we call that leadings, and we look at the open doors and closed doors and put out the fleece and have confirmations and have a piece about it. And all of those are ways to decipher the code. I just think that this is not taught in the Bible. And those verses that people have used as proof text for the idea don't teach that at all. When you look in context, it's not there. So if I say that God doesn't make your decisions for you, why should that foreclose on any meaningful relationship with God? This is what always mystifies me. Why is it when I say God is not going to talk to you, people say, well, then I can't have a relationship with God? Or what does a relationship with God look like? And what it intimates to me, Greg, is that for many people, relationship with God means God giving them private hints, nudges, and messages. And that's what a relationship is. And if I say that those things are not biblical, then they say there's no relationship. And that really mystifies me. It seems to me there are all kinds of things that are involved in relationship with God. People will say to me, look, how can we have a relationship without communication? That's just part of what they say, right? Well, what is this thing I'm holding in my hand? This is a big brown thing that has 66 books in it. What do you think it is? It's my Bible. What is that? Isn't this called God's what?
God's word.
Yeah. God's word. Mm-hmm. Isn't God's word a communication? So why doesn't God's word fulfill the requirements of communication from God to us that is necessary for a relationship? Do you notice how when I say God doesn't give us our own private revelations in this way by making our decisions for us and giving us all these little hints and pushes and nudges? And then people say, well, then there's no communication from God, that implicitly they're ruling out the Bible? Well, the Bible is chock full with communication from God and chock full with information to help us to determine, to make decisions in a godly, biblical way that are consistent with God's will, at least one understanding of the term God's will. So I don't see why it should be viewed that way at all. I know it is almost universally taken as that there is no relationship with God because each of us doesn't get a private revelation from God. But Christians have had vibrant relationships with God for thousands of years without getting their own special revelation. And people also ask me, what good is the Holy Spirit? I said, well, why don't you open your Bible and look up Holy Spirit and find all the places where the Bible talks about what the Holy Spirit does, and then you'll find what good the Holy Spirit is separate from private revelation for you. There's lots of teachings in the Bible about what the Holy Spirit does for us that has nothing to do with receiving private personal revelations. And a person can pick up a systematic theology, turn to Holy Spirit, and there it has it all. There's tons of things the Holy Spirit does in our life and God does in our life that does not require us to get private revelations from God about anything, much less about what we're supposed to do with our lives. This is a misconception. So I admit that relationship with God sounds a lot more jazzier if somebody is saying relationship means that you pray and then you be quiet and then God speaks to you and then he tells you what to do and go here and do that and take this job and marry that person and all that stuff. I understand how that can seem a lot more personal in one sense. It may be. The question isn't whether it's more personal. The question is whether it's sound, whether it's biblical, or whether we're following our own fancy. And I am convinced that we are following our own fancy in that thing. All right, Greg?
Okay, well, thank you very much.
I appreciate the call. Got to run. Time for break. And when I return, we'll take our last bank of callers here at Stand to Reason.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Okay, I guess we've been inspired here for the classical moments after talking about Paul Potts. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason, 1-800-227-5278. Line's open here, and we got plenty of time to talk. 754-4150, if you're in the Orange County 714 area code. I'll be getting to Maureen in Chicago in just a moment. The enforcer and I were just chatting just a little bit more about Paul Potts and the Nessun Dorma, this beautiful aria that he sang. It's a beautiful aria that he sang beautifully in this competition called Britain's Got Talent. I went through a phase of my life where I listened to a lot of
You want me to? Okay. Well, the enforcer is prevailing upon me right now to tell you the final outcome of the contest, which we found out just as we came to the show today. And when Paul Potts sang Nessun Dorma the first time, is coming out, as it were, that was in the quarterfinals. He made it into the semis. He did wonderfully there, won that, went to the finals, and today won the final. And therefore, he is the star of Britain right now, Paul Potts, and he's going to sing before the Queen. Apparently, he did the full rendition of Nessun Dorma, and in the initial one, you only get like 60 seconds, and that's what he did. But he did the full rendition. I imagine it's available somewhere on YouTube, and you can see the whole thing. Just wonderful. The reason I listen to opera, and I am particularly fond of Puccini, and I'm not an aficionado at all. What was wonderful about opera for me is that I didn't know what anybody was talking about. I don't know the German or the French or the Italian or, these different languages that opera is sung in. And, I did learn more about the pieces. So when I went to La Boheme and I actually saw the performance, I learned about the story and then followed it more. And I read the librettos. So I knew a little bit about what was being sung. And I know what's going on in this particular piece, Nessun Dorma, which means no one sleeps. And I know the story there, but the story is not important. It is not a principal importance to my point. It is the music that is transcendent. It isn't the story that's transcendent. It is the music. And when I would listen to some of these arias, I would be transported by the music. It bypassed my intellect completely. And this is why I don't care whether you're a opera fan or not. Maybe listening to Paul Potts will open up a new area of appreciation for you. Frankly, I don't think one exposure is going to do that. It takes some time to be exposed to this. But the thing that I think is so beautiful about it, you don't have to know what he's thinking about to sense and feel and participate in the pathos and to touch something transcendent. And that's the beauty of this kind of thing, and especially opera, in that it bypasses my intellect and goes right to my heart, if you will, for lack of a better way of putting it. All right, let's go to Chicago and Maureen. Welcome to Stand to Reason, Maureen.
Hi.
Hi there.
Happy Father's Day.
Thank you so much. You don't sound like you're from Chicago.
Oh, I am from Chicago.
Oh, you don't have that accent.
No, I don't have a Chicago accent, no.
Chicago, yeah. You don't. Good for you, I guess. But every once in a while, my friends can pick it up. There's a remnant of it in my voice, but I've left most of it behind, thankfully. It's not like Dennis Farina, the actor. He's from Chicago, and you can tell this guy's a Chicago guy from the city, because he talks that way. But anyway, what's on your mind, Maureen? Where in Chicago are you from, Maureen?
Well, north side, city of Chicago.
Oh, okay. So you know where Rogers Park is then?
Generally speaking,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just about 5 blocks south of Howard Street,
okay.
On the north end, so that's almost to Evanston. Okay, what's on your mind today, Maureen?
First of all, thanks for mentioning that Paul Potts guy. I saw that video and I just cried my eyes out.
Wasn't it something? Now, were you familiar with Nessun Dorma? Had you heard that piece before?
I don't think so. I'm not really an opera fan either,
right.
But I'm kind of a wannabe singer myself.
And, oh.
Not opera, but just...
Sure. American Idol type.
Just to see this average little guy that you would never think could make a sound like that, and to watch these people's faces when they, when he looked so... he couldn't even believe he was there.
Yes.
And it was just so
but funny. When he began to sing, he was totally into the moment. I mean, he really, he wasn't, he had tremendous delivery and composure. Even when the audience is crying and the people are clapping and everybody's kind of interrupting, they didn't wait. When he started hitting those high notes in the beginning of of his piece there, people realized that this was something special. And you notice people broke out in spontaneous applause.
It was just beautiful.
Yeah, so I'm glad you enjoyed it. Good. Did you find out about it through Stand to Reason?
Yeah, I think I did. Yeah, through
okay.
The blog. Yeah,
uh-huh.
I checked it out. And I was just...
Well, that's great. Okay. So what's on your mind today, Maureen?
My question also had to do with, the previous caller about decision-making.
Yes.
I think that my church does somewhat of a combination, I guess. Some of the language of, speaking, having God speak to you and being...
Uh-huh. And being led and all that, right.
Right, but the leadership is... there are people who read the Bible all the time, and they encourage us to, and they do use wisdom also.
Right. I think that is characteristic of most people who practice this method. They do read the Bible, and they do use wisdom, but they actually think they kind of try to do a combination of the two, and I think it just ends up being confusing and misleading for some people, because they think that they're looking for God to make the decision for them. And I think this is part of what can be very frustrating, because people are waiting around and they don't get the word, you know, from God, or they don't think they do. So that can be pretty hard. So what are you facing right now?
Well, I guess I was wondering what happens if you have made a decision that wasn't wise
uh-huh.
on purpose, but because of circumstances, it's very hard for me to make decisions because of this. You know, some things that are clearly stated are easy to do, but the other things like jobs and, you know, that type of thing is very difficult. And so sometimes I'll wait until the decision is made somehow for me.
Is it difficult because you don't know how to decide, or is it difficult because God seems to be silent and telling you what to do?
I don't know how to decide.
Have you gotten the decision-making material from Stand to Reason and looked at that?
Yes, I did, and I'm also reading the book. Okay, good. Yeah, I'm going through all that.
Sometimes, Maureen, it's just a life skill. I mean, if we set the spiritual stuff aside for a moment, okay, I talked in the first hour about parents, specifically dads, and how they influence their kids. Some dads train their children well to be competent in life, and some parents don't do that. And so kids are meandering, and they don't exactly know how to do things and carry on and what to do. And they're, you know, nobody ever taught me how to do this kind of thing. And so I wouldn't be surprised if you find yourself a little bit lost when you're having to make these decisions, because maybe nobody ever modeled it for you, or at least mentored you as a parent in how to be competent in certain kinds of things. Then what happens is then we go into the body of Christ, and then we're told that God is supposed to make the decisions anyway, so it doesn't matter if you're a good decision maker. God will tell you what to do, and then he doesn't tell you, or people can't figure out how to decipher the code. Now, I don't think there is any code, because I don't think God's making those decisions in those ways, but it leaves people like you maybe a little bit up in the air. So what happens now, you're saying when you've made a bad decision.
Made a bad decision.
That wasn't wise.
I guess what happens after that?
Well, it depends on what kind of decision it was.
I gave my notice at a bad job situation without having another job set up, which is obviously very unwise.
Oh, yeah, uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
What I was going to say is there are some decisions that are bad decisions that can't be reversed. You get married, you don't say, gee, that wasn't God's man for me. I made the wrong decision. No, maybe you made an unwise choice to begin with, but now it's God's will that people who are married stay married, you know, and so there are some things you can't undo like that. Other things you can. You just undo them. But in your case, have you already quit?
I have 2 weeks left. When I did give my notice, I was told that I was being replaced anyway.
Oh gosh, that's great.
Yeah, so it was kind of a
oops.
What about this timing?
Well, yeah, in a way, but it's like
the
thing is that you don't. It would have been better to wait until you had a job, or pretty close to it, before you left the first one. Now you found out that you were going to be replaced, so you would be facing this circumstance anyway.
Well, I was given somewhat of another option, of another position there, with the same pay and everything, but it was a very awkward, humiliating type of situation, you know,
yeah.
Where I have to explain, why am I training someone else, and why am I doing a job now that is so far beneath my skill level?
Uh-huh.
And
well, it's kind of hard, too. If you really want to go somewhere else, then it's kind of hard to say, okay, I'll take your job until I find this other job, until I find what I'm really after. So you've kind of got yourself in a pickle, and I don't know if you're going to be able to get out. It looks like in 2 weeks you're going to be bereft of employment.
It's done.
Do you have any savings or anything like that?
I have a little. I should be okay for a month.
All right. Well, that means in the next 6 weeks you have to work like crazy to find another source of income. And I think it's fine for you to look for something that you're really, really interested in, but pretty soon the reality of the circumstances is going to be that you're going to need a job of some sort. Now, do you have a pretty heavy nut to crack every single month in terms of your budget?
Yeah, it's pretty tight.
Okay, well, I don't know how to fix this. I would say pray hard and look hard, you know? This is like you're going to do both. You're going to do everything you can do, and you're going to ask God to do everything he can do. Because I don't know what else to tell you at this particular point. You need to job hunt really hard right now.
Yeah.
and give all of your thought to that and all your prayers to that, and ask your friends to help out and keep their eyes open and, you know, press every button and overturn every rock. So 6 weeks from now, you're not unemployed and broke. And it may be that what you settle for now is something you settle for in the short term to give you breathing room to make a more permanent long-term decision. That's okay. Some people might be thinking, well, why don't you just let God tell you what job to get and God to provide and all that? Well, God usually doesn't drop jobs in your lap. It's our responsibility to go out and seek those kinds of things, trusting in Him and asking Him to help. But we're not pushed into a passive mode.
Right.
And it also, I see no place in the Scripture where God tells us that He's going to tell us what job we're going to have. This just isn't there. This is one of our decisions, and He's entrusted us with those things. It doesn't mean He's totally out of the picture, but it means we have a responsibility to go ahead and do that. So that's the best I can do with you on the short notice here.
All righty. Thanks.
Okay. Sorry so much about your situation, and maybe there's some things to learn in this one, okay?
All right, thanks.
All right, all the best. Let's go to Jerry. Let's see, Jerry, we're really short on time. What's on your mind, Jerry?
Okay, good afternoon, Craig.
Good afternoon.
I read recently where you're very good, and then one we respect, Francis Beck, with
yes.
Return to Catholicism.
Yes, that's
correct. I want to know, have you had any interactions with him on this?
Well, I haven't talked to Frank directly about this. I've been running a lot, and let's go to 58, yes. And I haven't. I was just talking to Melinda on that. We're going to take a couple more minutes here to talk with you about this. I haven't talked to Frank directly, and I've emailed him just a small amount. He sent me a whole bunch of stuff that I haven't had time to get to.
Yeah.
So I've been saving all of this stuff. I've read a few of it. Now, Melinda, the enforcer, has had a lot of interaction with Frank.
Yes.
And so she's passed a number of things by him, and I'm privy to those conversations. So in a sense, by proxy, I've had conversations with Frank because Melinda and I have talked about these issues, and she's written to him about them. So we have had some conversation, but it's been limited.
Well, is he now he has supposedly read the early church fathers. That's convinced him, right? That was a convincing point?
Well, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, that the early church fathers convinced him. I think that Frank had some personal reasons to be drawn to or to migrate back to the Roman Catholic Church, and he read enough about the early church fathers to make him feel comfortable with this decision and also Rome's view on justification. Now, there are, I think, a number of things that he hasn't thought about. He hasn't thought about the inclusivism that is taught out of Rome now. And that, I think, is a serious problem. Even though C.S. Lewis was a kind of inclusivist when pushed came to shove, Roman Catholicism now is a very, very very inclusivist, much more aggressively than they were. Frank discovered that the early church fathers, he felt, were consistent with Rome and didn't find a problem there. I don't know if he would argue that the early church fathers were Roman Catholic. That's another issue. We're actually going to have Frank on the air, I think, next month.
Next month?
And we're going to, in July sometime, maybe. We're working on that.
Oh, really?
I'm not entirely sure whether it would be a real productive conversation. And that's what we're kind of working through. He's given a lot of interviews. He's in print on this so people can have access to his ideas and the reasons that he made his decision. But I'm not sure if we're going to pursue that here in the air, but we have been in conversation with him, and we have not been impressed by the reasons he's given. Let's just leave it at that. Jerry, thanks for the call, and that's it for our show. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being my guest for the last 2 hours. I look forward to the next time we talk. In the meantime, go out and be a good ambassadors for Christ, all right? That means being intentional about having an accurately informed mind, an artful method, and an attractive manner. I'm Greg Kolkel for Stand to Reason. You go out and give them heaven this week, my friends. Take care. Bye-bye.